capitalism on the program today. Love it or hate it? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, 16 May. Glad as always to have you with us, everybody. We opened up our folder labeled Deadlines That Aren't Really Deadlines this morning, and we found the NAFTA renegotiations. When last we checked in with Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, you might remember, he had said tomorrow was supposed to be it. Deal in Congress's hands, or it wasn't going to get done this year. After some backing and forthing among the three parties, though, that would be the United States, Canada, and Mexico, if you need the refresher, deadlines, it seems, are malleable. So progress to come, perhaps. But amidst the deadline push, there has also been talk that maybe negotiators ought to just sharpen their focus a wee bit and try to tackle fewer issues. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson wades into the trade options.
Think of it as a slimmed down or skinny NAFTA.
I think a skinny NAFTA, the language is borrowed from the healthcare reform.
Christopher Sands is a research professor at Johns Hopkins University.
If you can't get consensus on the big pieces, can you at least do a small bill that offends the least number of people and might have enough votes to get through Congress?
So maybe a skinny NAFTA would update rules governing autos and auto parts, or say e-commerce, and a few other issues the countries can agree on. But the rest, the stuff the countries can agree on, would just be set aside, left as is. Stephen Coe, a partner with the law firm Akin Gump, says theoretically tackling fewer issues could mean a faster deal. But he's skeptical about the prospects of a skinny NAFTA.
It may be driven by the pressures of time, but it's hard to tell how real it is. The U.S. certainly hasn't said anything in support of it.
In fact, the Trump administration has repeatedly stressed the need for a complete overhaul. So Lori Wallach, director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, also believes a trimmed-down NAFTA wouldn't fly with negotiators or President Trump.
I think until they have a good deal, they don't have a deal, both because it won't do what he's going to be held accountable to.
Like tackling outsourcing and trade imbalances.
And because it won't get through Congress.
Plus, Wallach thinks there's actually more time to get the deal through Congress than Speaker Ryan's allowed. She says negotiations could stretch well into June and still make it through Congress this year. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
One of the big points in the U.S.-Canada trade relationship as those NAFTA negotiations continue is lumber. The United States put new duties on Canadian softwood lumber earlier this year, and the price of 2x4s used in framing houses, among other things, has since gone, well, up. Good for the American lumber industry. Not so good for pretty much everybody else, including home builders. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank has that one.
Lumber prices have risen more than 50% since the start of last year. Timber analyst Steve Chirkover at D.A. Davidson.
The spark or the catalyst for this increase was the duties.
Duties on Canadian softwood lumber. The Trump administration imposed tariffs of more than 20% back in January. U.S. officials claim Canada improperly subsidizes its industry by charging minimal logging fees on public lands. Chirkover says the tariffs are affecting a key segment of the American economy.
The simplest and most egregious impact is that U.S. consumers are paying too much for lumber.
Higher lumber prices mean more expensive new houses. CEO Frank Fafahi at Proto Homes in Los Angeles says he's had to pass costs on to customers.
What it does is shrinks our margin. So we try to save on the cost of labor so we can offset the cost of lumber to some degree.
New home construction declined last month, held down in part by those high lumber costs. Robert Dietz is chief economist at the National Association of Home Builders.
The lumber increases have resulted in a gain to home prices of about $7,000 in terms of the cost to home buyers.
Dietz expects a lot of continued volatility in the lumber market.
When you've got aluminum and steel tariffs being discussed, NAFTA being renegotiated, we're certainly in an environment where there's a lot of uncertainty.
And that uncertainty comes at a time when home builders are already struggling to build enough new homes to satisfy demand. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
The economic news of the week is more than just trade, of course. A bunch of big retailers report earnings this week, Walmart, Nordstrom, and JCPenney among them. But today, well, today belonged to Macy's. After years of struggling through the brick and mortar apocalypse, this morning the company posted numbers that blew past pretty much all expectations. Investors were surprised, to say the least, and as Marketplace's Rima Crace reports, they were not the only ones.
Jeff Gannett was surprised, and that in itself is surprising. Gannett is CEO of Macy's. Here he is on the earnings call earlier today.
We continued our momentum from the holiday season into the first quarter. In fact, exceeding our own expectations on most measures.
Measures like revenue, up 3.6%, and profit, up 78%.
I can imagine sitting inside a traditional retailer where you're feeling under siege, that it is surprising to have a performance as they've had.
Vandana Radhakrishnan is with Bain & Company. She's talking about feeling under siege by who else? Amazon. But she says many department stores have been finding ways to fight back.
Winning retailers are those that really use their store as an advantage.
By introducing exclusive lines, creating in-store events, and improving overall customer service. Radhakrishnan says it's also about mashing up the digital and physical worlds.
There are various formulas for that, but, you know, buy online, pick up in store, you ship from store.
Many retailers are also getting a boost from something beyond their control, a strong economy, says James Boniker of IHS Market.
Job market's the best it's been since 2000. You know, wages are rising.
Still, Boniker says, big picture, retail sales at department stores as a whole have been steadily falling for a dozen years.
Retail isn't suffering as bad as it was a couple of years ago, but, you know, retailers are still adjusting.
And he says if the economy takes a turn or shoppers cut back, the bad old days could make a return. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
Ticker symbol M, by the way, today for Macy's, up 10.8%. The broader market's nowhere near as good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Just because you can't get too ready too soon, I will point out here that there are just 173 shopping days left until the 2018 midterm elections. We are, as you know, smack in the middle of primary season, a bunch yesterday, more in the coming weeks. And much as it is in other aspects of our lives, data is huge in modern politics. Your data in particular, how campaigns get it and how they use it. Cambridge Analytica has been getting all the attention, but that's national level politics, right? We're going to take a look down ballot. That person running in a congressional primary on a shoestring budget. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams caught up with just such a candidate in Maryland the other day.
It's one of the first warm days of spring, perfect for some old-fashioned campaigning in the suburban community of Rockville, Maryland.
Where am I turning?
Rocking Spring Drive, 0.3 miles.
Republican congressional candidate Ami Hober is slowly driving her tan sedan emblazoned with campaign stickers along a tree-lined street, searching for addresses with the help of her campaign field director and navigator, Dan McHugh.
Where are we going?
We're looking for 17 and 16.
16 is right there.
Okay, this isn't quite old-fashioned campaigning. Hober and McHugh aren't going door-to-door. They're targeting specific homes on specific blocks in specific neighborhoods in Maryland's 6th District. Addresses McHugh is pulling from an app called Advantage.
They get data for us on the voters that we're trying to target. Right now is a lot of Republicans. We're hitting soft Democrats. We are hitting some independents.
Voters who might like Hober's background as a former deputy undersecretary of the Army or her efforts to prevent Maryland from becoming a sanctuary state. This isn't expensive Cambridge Analytica-style data that gives you a personality profile. It's basic. Name, age, gender, low-hanging data fruit. Most of it from state and local election boards.
And it has whether or not the person voted in each election going back close to 20 years in most states.
Not a small thing, says David Nickerson, a political scientist at Temple University. Hober is up against three other Republicans in a June primary and needs to maximize her time and money.
It doesn't make sense to knock on the doors and try to persuade them of people who've never voted.
Nickerson says basic voter data may cost 100, maybe 150 bucks at the local level. Candidates can then buy lists of updated phone numbers, people's shopping habits, other information that will better identify likely voters. But, says Nickerson,
the best data available is coming from the national parties who are in the business of giving it at subsidized rates to the state party,
who then pass it on to the candidates they want to support. Short of that, the basic technology is good enough for even small campaigns with limited funds to get pretty specific. Hober, for instance, is confident enough in her data that she doesn't even leave campaign leaflets at homes not on her list. It's a risk she's willing to take, although she does stop to chat with random people she meets along the way.
Hello.
Hi.
My name is Ami Hober.
Sometimes it's a little harder to get her message across.
We have a contractor. Thank you. No. I'm Ami Hober. I'm running for Congress.
Hober ran for Congress in the last election and lost, but she still has some name recognition.
Okay. I know enough about you.
You do? Okay.
I voted for you last time.
All right. He was enthusiastic.
Yeah.
And let me get the one across the street.
Enthusiastic, positive, negative, not home, all details that get plugged into the app.
And so we put in feedback when we get feedback like that, so it reinforces the validity of the database. That means this is a good house to hit. He votes all the time. He'll vote for us.
And that database gets refined every day, every week, right up until Election Day. In Rockville, Maryland, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
There were more than a million international students enrolled in American colleges and universities last year, and all told, they account for very close to $40 billion worth of economic activity. But back in 2016, the number of new international students showing up here started to flatten out a little bit. There are a lot of reasons for that, but one of them is that a lot of foreign students don't always speak college-level English. There are language programs they can take before starting their actual degree work, but as WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports, demand for those English language programs is down as well, which means a lesser supply of those courses, and so on.
19-year-old Ali Ashkenani came to Philadelphia from Kuwait last fall. He says he realized pretty quickly that the English pronunciation he learned in school wasn't going to cut it if he was going to pursue an industrial engineering degree in the States. Take the common phrase, bottle of water.
In our country, we said bottle of water. But here, barrel of water.
To bridge those gaps, Ashkenani began an intensive English program at Temple University. These kinds of full-time immersive English programs prepare non-native speakers to get a college degree in the U.S. At Temple, a three-month session runs about $5,800. At the front of his advanced listening and speaking class, lecturer Ann Dramel gets ready to quiz students from places like Saudi Arabia and New Caledonia on their vocabulary.
We're going to play a game with these words, so now's your chance to ask questions.
There are about 10 students in class today, and a lot of empty seats. Dramel says 3 or 4 years ago, it was common to have classes with more than 20 students. Not anymore.
For example, my reading and writing class, both of those have 9 students each, which that's the least I have ever taught, ever.
That story of intensive English classes shrinking by half repeats itself across the country. Cheryl Delk-Lagood is the executive director of English USA, a trade association for intensive English language programs. She says one reason for the decline is that students are comparison shopping and finding it's cheaper to learn English somewhere else.
The Australian market is very attractive for students. Canada, of course, and the UK, Philippines, even, you know, some of these countries and locations are closer and the cost of living is lower.
Open Doors, a group that tracks international student enrollment for the State Department, found intensive English language programs in the U.S. declined by 26% last year, the second big drop in 2 years. University administrators are quick to point out there's no single cause. Reese Heitner, the interim director of Drexel University's English Language Center, says many schools had become dependent on students sent by scholarship programs in countries like Saudi Arabia and Brazil.
Those scholarship programs have been tightened and the money isn't as forthcoming, and there are fewer students who are a product of that scholarship program.
Heitner says Drexel's English Language Center didn't hire adjunct teachers this year, down from needing 24 a few years ago. What about Ali Ashkenani, the 19-year-old aspiring engineer? He says he's jazzed about how much English he's learned in a short period of time.
For the first few weeks, I didn't understand nothing in the classes. But now I really love it. I have no problem to stay here for 10 years after I go back to my country.
Like a lot of American students who go abroad, he says coming here was as much about learning a new culture as going to school. In Philadelphia, I'm Laura Benshoff for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I don't think it needs defending. I think it needs understanding.
Capitalism. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 62 today, 0.25%, 24,768 on the blue chips. NASDAQ up 46 points, about 0.6%, 73.98. The S&P 500 11 points higher, 0.4%, 27.22. Took a look at how home builders are being burned by high lumber costs with those new duties on Canadian softwood. So here's some timber producers. Seattle-based Weyerhaeuser climbed 0.4% today. The Canadian forestry company West Fraser Timber grew 4.8%. Canadian Resolute Forest Products rose 0.9% today. Bond prices, why they fell. When that happens, the yield goes up. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note, 3.1% today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Some of you are going to know the name of this next guest, and some of you won't, and that's okay, because you almost certainly know the name of the company he helped start. Ken Langone is one of the co-founders of The Home Depot. He's also been an entrepreneur and an investment banker. He has been around this economy for a good long while now, and now he's an author as well. His memoir is called I Love Capitalism, and I should say here there's an exclamation point in that title. Ken Langone, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
So this is about as full-throated a defense of capitalism as you are ever going to read. And I guess my first question is, why do you think capitalism needs defending right now?
I don't think it needs defending. I think it needs understanding. In the 2016 campaign, as I watched Bernie Sanders' campaign, it dawned on me the massive number of young people that were showing up for him. And the thing that frightened me was, well, these kids haven't even started yet, and they're giving up. Capitalism works. Admittedly, there are winners and losers, but it works. Certainly, I think if you look at the history of our great nation, it certainly made a massive contribution to where we are today vis-a-vis the rest of the world, for sure.
So people who listen to this program regularly will know that I read the acknowledgments section of a book before I read anything else. And The thing about this book that you have written, I Love Capitalism! Exclamation point, is that the acknowledgments come in the beginning. There are, I think, 5 pages where you just list people who have helped you out and assisted you through your career. And I think the thing that you didn't say when you were talking about the benefits of capitalism is that you need help along the way.
A whole lot. Kai, I am anything but a self-made man. You need to have a team of people, and you need to have them feel they're with you, not for you. And that list, I deliberately wanted that list, and I pray to God I haven't left anybody off the list. If I did, it's a mistake. But every one of those people on that list in one way or other contributed to my journey through life.
So let me try the spirit of that question in a different way, and let me ask it this way. You talk in the first chapter or two of this book about your freshman year of college at Bucknell, which in itself was sort of a miracle that it happened because you really weren't thinking about college and all of this. But you get to college, you're having a good old time, probably too good a time, right, as you say.
You bet.
And this professor sits you down as you're about to fail out and says, I am going to help you. I am going to go around to all your professors and tell them basically that you're a diamond in the rough and to give you a chance. Where would you be if that guy hadn't helped you out that way?
Well, I wouldn't be where I am today. The fellow's name was Russ Headley.
Yeah.
He was the professor of economics at Bucknell. I certainly wouldn't be. As I said, Professor Headley is one name. But you pick a name that certainly was pivotal at that moment in time. And all the names I've listed in the book were pivotal to my career or my path at the point in time when they were in my life or were involved with me in some activity, whether it was a business or a charitable cause or whatever it was.
So what do you do, Mr. Langone, if you're one of the people in this economy?
Call me Ken,
have,
please.
I will do that. What do you do, Ken? I apologize for my formality. It's reflex. What do you do if you're somebody in this economy, and there are many of them, who don't have people to help them out.
I feel very sorry for them. What do I do? I feel very, I think there couldn't be a more lonely existence than not have at least one person in your life at any one point in time in your life that you couldn't pick up the phone or you couldn't go see and say, hey, what do you think? Or I need your help. Or can you do this for me? Or can you do me this favor? So that description you tell me about that person, that's a very sad. I will tell you this, though, and I don't mean this in a lecturing way. My father had a wonderful expression. He said, if you want to have a friend, you got to be a friend. So maybe that fellow wants to take a step back and ask himself the question, what has he done to nurture those kinds of friendships and relationships?
I do want to say here, just to give the other side of the coin its due, that you have been extremely active in philanthropy, that you have taken the money you made at the Home Depot and on Wall Street and many other places, and you've given back to the community. Not all, though, in your position do that. And I wonder what your thoughts are on the high and rising level of inequality in this economy.
Okay. I think anybody whose possessions are theirs are theirs to do with what they want for whatever reason. First, I would say to you, I would rather be remembered as a philanthropist who gave up his time and his talent. All the money I've given back, I've made it all back and more. And I believe a driving force behind any kind of success is a faith and belief in yourself. So anything you can do that nurtures self-confidence or self-respect is to the good.
Let me circle back to where we started, which is the defense of capitalism that this book is, how you came to write it, which is watching Bernie Sanders promise many, many things without explanation of how they were going to be paid for during the 2016 campaign.
Right.
But then
right.
Also the ultimate result of the 2016 election, which is Donald Trump as president of the United States, a man whose candidacy you supported, whose policies you support. Do you think the average American is going to be better off under Mr. Trump's economic policies?
Well, what objective measure do we want to use? Look at the unemployment rate in America today. I can tell you right now, virtually every businessman I know says the environment in Washington is more constructive for business than it's been in a long, long time. Look, we have a shortage of qualified labor in America today. We have a shortage. 10 years ago, people were worried about what they were going to do to feed their families. You know, and the other part of that equation, Kai, is public education. We need to get these kids prepared to take advantage of these jobs. I think if we fix that problem, we'll go a long way towards solving an even bigger problem, which is income inequality. We can't afford to allow our income inequality grow. It's got to contract, and we've got to bring more people to the party. That's an obligation of capitalism. That's a responsibility we capitalists all have, and we got to do better.
Ken Lengo. You've probably been to the company he founded. It's called the Home Depot. He's got a new book out.
I co-founded it. I had three of a partner.
Co-founded. There you go. To the very end of the interview, dishing out the credit, right?
Well, Bernie Marcus, Arthur Blank, Pat Farah, and 400,000 other wonderful people that go to Home Depot every day to pursue their careers.
Ken Langone. The book is called I Love Capitalism. Ken, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Kai, thanks for having me on your show.
Two quick things. We've got an excerpt from I Love Capitalism up at our website, marketplace.org. Also, a couple of months ago, we had Greg Minear, the CEO of the Home Depot, on the program. You can hear that interview on our Corner Office podcast. The Just final note on the way out today, which I am obliged to mention might not be entirely suitable for younger listeners. Reuters is reporting that as part of its bankruptcy proceedings, Toys R Us is looking to sell off its intellectual property, including its Babies R Us brand, also its mascot, Jeffrey the Giraffe. Now, tough as that might be for kids to deal with, here is the rest of it. Also included in the sale are some of the internet domain names the company registered to prevent, shall we say, malicious use. Among them, IHateToysRUs.com, also AdultToysRUs.com. There are more, but this is a family program, so I'm going to stop. All right, we got to go. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.